My name's Scott Redmond. I'm an alcoholic. Hi, buddy. I'd like to thank y'all for bringing me up to talk tonight. Happy birthday to all the birthday people. And I'd like to thank my host, Roger. He's been a great host, taking real good care of me. And if you're new, I'd like to welcome you to AA and tell you that I have a great life today. And if you're new, I'm sure that thrills the crap out of you. I'm sure that just really thrills you, really excites you that I'm having a good time, because I know how excited I was for the people having a good time in AA when I got here. And I'd listen to them talk about the new house and the car and stuff, and I'd sit in my seat and I'd think, you know, maybe you'll go home tonight and maybe your house will blow up. Maybe you'll blow up. Then we'll see how spiritual you are next week. If you're new, you are now privy to an unending, unsolicited reservoir of information and advice. They are going to get right up in your face and talk that endless AA crap to you. It's usually a guy with one tooth with a cavity in it. You know the guy. He's got a belt buckle large enough to serve a whole fish on. Do I want what you've got? No! No, but thanks for spitting on me. If you know, I'd like to welcome you to the program. If you're a drug addict, I'd like to welcome you to AA. If you're a dope fiend, which is somehow worse than any of us, I'd like to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. And just suggest that you stick around long enough to catch alcoholism. Just catch alcoholism. We'd love to give it to you. I kind of collect new and interesting ways I hear people identify. I love Tweaker. I don't know what you... Are you guys like a cleaning product or something? What the hell is that? But I like Tweaker, and my second... this buddy of mine calls me. We every time we hear a new one, we kind of call each other and share it. And my friend Charlie called me and told me that he heard a guy identify as a crack monster. Ooh, that's scary. Crack monster. Ooh. You can have anything you want, but just in addition to it, catch alcoholism. We have a book written by alcoholics about alcoholism. We don't have a book for dope juggernaut. If you're the Bigfoot of dope addicts, if you're a dope Goliath, can't help you out with that. But we can help you if you catch alcoholism. I did not have alcoholism when I came to AA. So if you're not an alcoholic, I'd like to welcome you here and just suggest that you stick around long enough to get a diagnosis. I did not have alcoholism when I got here. I'm Jewish, number one, and Jews don't drink. Because it might dull the pain, you know? And, you don't want that to happen. You don't want to squander any agony opportunity that presents itself. In addition to being Jewish, I could not possibly have been an alcoholic. I had been in psychotherapy for 18 years. I was going to be dead, but I was going to understand it. I'm not putting therapy down. Therapy's great stuff. It says on page 133 of our book, if you need a doctor, go get one. My colossal blunder is I was trying to treat alcoholism with psychotherapy. Now, if alcoholism is a threefold illness, if it's a weird physical reaction that makes it utterly impossible to leave the stuff alone or to stop once we begin or to moderate, and if you're special, try some controlled crack smoking. You know, just fill your mouth with crack smoke, say, geez, I'm just not in the mood today, and blow it out. Hats will fill the air. But if you have this weird physical reaction to alcohol, and it's coupled with what you'll hear at the meetings referred to as alcoholic thinking, it's fabulous stuff. It's the source of a lot of mirth at the meetings. It's great. And I love reasons to drink. On the first page of chapter 4 in our book, it basically says that facing an alcoholic death or a spiritual life is not always an easy decision to make. And spiritual life, pool of my own urine. Spiritual life, pool. And my friend, I have a friend named Larry who says the first time he ever read that sentence, he said to himself, well, how bad an alcoholic death are we talking about here? That's not a normal response to that question. the alcoholic mind is like a perfectly tuned clock that keeps the most precise exact time in the universe for 30 seconds and then skips a century. When it works, it's gorgeous and flawless, and when it doesn't, it leaves gaps large enough to move an entire culture through. It's extraordinary stuff and very baffling. I collect reasons to drink, and my most recent one, and it is one of the most gorgeous exhibitions of alcoholic thinking I've ever heard. I was sponsoring this guy for about 15 minutes, and he lived with his wife. He was a male prostitute, and he had a gay lover, and he called me to tell me that he drank. And I said, no, why? I want to know. He said, man, I caught my wife cheating on me. It doesn't get any better than that. You can't write that. They'll throw you out of the office if you write that. Once this weird thinking keeps driving you to take a drink, you can't stop taking. You start rearranging your entire life to accommodate a walk to a drink. You can't stop drinking. And this cancer of the soul begins. This soul sickness that snatches alcoholics away from any possibility of human help. Always good news for the new man beyond human help. Very exciting for them. And if I have that, if I have this weird thinking, this mental, physical, and spiritual illness, and I'm trying to treat it with psychotherapy, which is mental, which would be one-fold, I'm two-fold short. I'm showing up at a gunfight with a knife, basically, and getting my ass kicked. You know, really kicked over and over and over again. And it was very, very confusing to me. So that was another reason I was not an alcoholic. I was not only Jewish, I had been in psychotherapy for 18 years, and I was not alcoholic. I was a dark, adventurous artist, but not alcoholic. And if you're new here again, I want to suggest that you stick around long enough to get a diagnosis. I was brought up in the Bronx in New York City. Anybody? What? Witness Protection Program? Yeah? Yeah? I love when you're out of town, like in Montana, and there's Vito, you know? Yeah, yeah. Yeah, from Montana, you know. I love the prairie, you know. Yeah, right. To a completely insane family. My family was completely psychotic, and my wife never believed me about them, and Mom threw an engagement party for us, and my aunt came and wore her wig backwards, and it had a bun on it. I wish I was lying about this. These are my people. This is my genetic pool. And if you're new here, the reason why I mention this, and I'm just telling you kind of like, that's a cute story, and then there was the uncute stories, like the physical and mental abuse and the chronic institutionalization and suicide attempts. And if you're new here, I want to tell you something. It's a very important thing for me to know. My family did not have one single thing to do with making me an alcoholic. I'm not saying they weren't nuts. They were nuts. I had a uncle who was a boxer during the late 30s named Izzy Redman, who was concerned about anti-Semitism when he fought down south and changed his name to Izzy Goldberg. And again, I really wish I was lying about this. The ice is getting very thin in and around there. They did not have one single thing to do with making me an alcoholic. And that might be really confusing to you if you're new, because a lot of bad stuff might have happened to you. And I am not for one second telling you that it didn't happen. Really bad stuff. I'm telling you that it can't make me an alcoholic. If this is really mental, physical, and spiritual, and my emotional problems, if my family had made me an alcoholic, then it stands to figure I could go to psychotherapy, get analyzed, and drink properly. If they had really made me an alcoholic, I wouldn't have to go to parties anymore and say, oh, no heroin for me, I'll have a Perrier, right? I wouldn't have to do that, I could just be like the normal people. So I was growing up in the Bronx, and I entered psychotherapy at a very young age, and that really helped me dodge this really awful alcoholic dilemma I was in. because I was an alcoholic from the gate. And the other method that I used to avoid catching alcoholism, and it worked for a long time, was I drank till I didn't want to be a drunk, and I overcame my alcohol problem with marijuana. I'd like to welcome all the pot smokers here tonight. You remember WOW, right?
Wow. Wow.
Right after WOW usually came, what? What?
Wow, what?
Watching a pot smoker is like watching a dog try to run on linoleum. You know? There's like a lot of activity, but no movement. But they're busy, busy, busy people. They just can't get a claw in the rug. Highly. I triumphed over marijuana with pills. I was victorious over pills with cocaine. Cocaine is an excellent drug. It's particularly good for sex if you enjoy sex from the Neolithic period. And I kicked that goddamn cocaine with heroin. Heroin's a very dark, artistic, you know, drug. And then you cross a line and become a vomiting pig. It's just a little hop, skip, and a jump there. And I drank throughout and swapped addictions and was almost dead from alcoholism by the time I started catching it when I was 33 years old. And I was loaded on heroin the night my father died. I didn't plan it that way. I just had slammed some dope. I was called to the hospital. He had a massive stroke. I couldn't show up for him or my mother or my brother, and I collapsed as a man, as a son. I felt like a pig, like an animal. Probably a few times in a kid's life you ought to be there for his dad, and I couldn't answer the bell. And my father was lost to me. I couldn't think about him. I couldn't talk about him. I couldn't even look at pictures out of him. I couldn't even hear the sound of a heart machine. It sounded like a personal indictment of my failure as a man. I never felt like a grown man anyway. I never felt like a grown man until I started doing the work in AA. My whole life, no matter how old I was, I stood next to men 10 years younger than me and said, I wonder what it feels like to be grown up. And it's a crappy way to live. You're always a dime short and a dollar late, man. You're never in your life. It's a horrible way to live. And I knew what the problem was that night, and I knew how to solve it. The problem was that goddarn heroin, and I swore I would never put a needle in my arm again, and I didn't. Shortly after that, I met an extraordinary woman, beautiful, exotic woman from Detroit. I thought she was exotic. I had been in the Bronx my whole life. I thought there were like palm trees in Detroit, you know. I set some lofty goals for myself as a young man, and by the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had reached or surpassed them all. Because, you see, I was not going to be a loser like my old man and make money and bring it home. There was no way. No way, thank you very much, that I was going to be suckered into something like that. And by the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had a book on the bestseller list. I had acted in a Broadway play. I had directed a television show. I directed a movie. I had had my own theater in New York. I had done all of these things a time. I never got to do any of them more than once, because when I'd leave, they'd move the business, so I couldn't find it again. And the reason why, I didn't find out until I took the alcoholic test. And if you're new here, we have a test. Other diseases have blood tests and x-rays. We have an inventory. It's a pass-pass situation. All you have to do is do it, and you'll pass. And if you do it, if you actually do it, if you actually write the whole thing and read it to somebody else, the whole thing. I'm resentful at them. I'm resentful at me for resenting them. I'm resentful at them for watching me resent them. All right? And I've had sex with all of them. All right? If you read the whole thing, you might be so crushed under the weight of it that you might be so devastated and deflated of ego at depth and convinced that your plan might not be working out, that you might become available for the treatment for alcoholism we have. You see, if you knew you've been treating your own alcoholism, and it's not working out. Your treatment's not working out. No one's ever gotten better from anything using your treatment, and the numbers are dwindling. And what I saw when I took the picture of my alcoholism was that early on, people were doing things behind my back. A little later on, they started talking behind my back. And in those last few horrible years, they started thinking behind my back. which is horrible. It's hard to catch them. But you can. You have to accuse them of it all the time. Right? Right? And you'll get, you do get them eventually. And that was my explanation for my career is continually falling apart on me. And Nancy and I met her. She was an usherette in the Broadway house that I was playing, and it was very romantic, and we fell in love right away. And we had great dreams and great aspirations. We were in our young 20s. We were in New York. I was on Broadway. We had the whole world laid at our feet. Nancy had a great idea for a career, and she had begun her career. And we were going nowhere fast. I mean, we had alcoholism. We didn't even know we had it. But we were a couple of dogs trying to run on linoleum because we weren't going anywhere. And Nancy became very sick from prolonged exposure to me. And we became so sick that at one point a guy lent us his car and we sold his car. I will never forget this guy's voice on the phone as long as I live. He said, "You sold my car?" That's like house sitting for someone and they come back and you're in escrow, you know? And we were proud of what we had done. It was the end of the month. We didn't have the rent. I looked into my wife's eyes. I said, "I'm sick of acting like a punk, irresponsible kid. Let's not borrow money. Let's stand on our own 2 feet. Let's sell the car." And she looked at me with tears in her eyes and said, "Let's do." That guy, when I called him to pay him back, his voice was exactly the same. This is 16 years later. He said, "You're paying me back?" It was like he was frozen on that end of the phone, you know, all that stuff. We had 2 children. When Micah was born, we were surrounded by friends and family. There was a ton of phone calls, a lot of people at the hospital. And 2 years and 9 months later, when Jesse was born, there was no one at the hospital, no phone calls, no flowers. We had been completely isolated by the disease of alcoholism in 2 years and 9 months. And it's not because people didn't love us. It just hurt too much to be around us. And Jesse had a little heart deal when he was newborn, and he went up to neonatal intensive care. And this doctor called me and said, "Mr. Redman, you know, your wife is in very, very bad shape. She's all alone down here. The baby's in an incubator. We really need you to come down here." And I said to this doctor, "I'd love to do that, but the fact is I can't find anybody to watch my 2-year-old son." And this doctor, who I had never met before, said an extraordinary thing to me on the phone that day. She said, "I tell you what, why don't I give you my home number? And you call it, and you bring your kid over to my house, and my husband will watch him so you can come down here." I mean, this is a remarkable thing for a doctor to do who I've never met. And I said no. There was no way that I could accept that kindness or that generosity from that person. I was too racked with guilt and self-loathing. And it wasn't like I was doing my son Micah a favor by staying with him. Now he was trapped in the house with this crazy man. I would have done better to take him down to the hospital, leave him in the waiting room of the coloring book. At least he could have gotten away from me for a while. And this is the condition that we were in by the time we got to AA. But one of my favorite parts of our book is when Bill describes a condition that was absolutely unbearable, unthinkable. A situation in his life where you can't even imagine going on for one more afternoon. And then he says at the end of the paragraph, "Little were we to know that this was to continue for 3 more years. And it wasn't until Jesse was 3 that I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. So it was 3 years on the nose for us. And what happens is you rearrange your life to accommodate alcoholism. That's the process of alcoholism. You rearrange what it's okay to do, what it's okay to be, where it's okay to go, what it's okay to think. It all gets accommodated and tweaked and re-tweaked. There's that word again. That's it. That's it. To accommodate the inexplicable walk to the drink. What it became okay to do in our house, this is what became okay. This is a good morning in the Redmond home. I went to the doctor. He said, "You have high blood pressure, Mr. Redmond, and you're going to have to lose some weight in order to bring it down." And I said, "Look, I would love to do that, but the fact is I before I go to bed every night, I drink alcohol and I smoke marijuana, so I won't be able to do that." And he said, "Why don't I prescribe some medication for you?" I said, "What a country." So he prescribed for me chloral hydrate. Now, if you've ever seen those 30s films where there's a disruptive sailor in a bar and they put some white powder into his drink and he drinks it and falls backwards like a potted palm, that's chloral hydrate. It's a Mickey. It's a knockout drop. And I love these pills. I love them. Nancy comes home, and I'm taking handfuls of chlorohydrate and slamming my arms into the wall to keep myself awake to enjoy my knockout drops. Because you don't want to waste them, right? So I'm taking these pills, and I'm slamming body parts into the wall to keep myself awake and until I just seize and just keel over. So now I'm going to bed, and now I'm incontinent like any other normal 30-year-old man because I got so much Mickey in me, I can't get up to go to the bathroom. One night, I got up and wet the wall. And in the morning, everyone was excited. I had wet the wall. I was headed towards that bathroom. It's progress, not perfection, right? We're getting some movement here. It appeared as though I was homing in on the actual bathroom. It was a Wheaties morning in the Redmond home, you know? Well, that would be a good Wheaties box cover, kind of, wouldn't it? Man. On April 20th, 1985, after those 3 years were up and the careers were pretty much gone and our lives had run out between our fingers like a handful of water over and over and over again, I put a needle in my arm. I crossed a line that I swore I would never cross. Everything was okay. Everything was okay as long as I didn't cross that line. And I crossed it, and my world came crashing down around me. Now, why? I couldn't tell you, because I had broken a lot of absolute rules for myself many, many times. Why that day? Why that morning? I have no idea. But I put a needle in my arm. I called my therapist of record that day, my first Jungian therapist. I told him what I had done, and he told me that, he said to me, there's absolutely nothing that can be done for you. And I said, what? He said, I can't help you. The only thing I can suggest is you attend a meeting of Narcotics Anonymous, Alcoholics Anonymous, or we have you institutionalized. Now, why I went to that AA meeting, I couldn't tell you, because most other days I would have gladly chosen the institution. Near the end, I got excited when they told me I needed dental surgery near the end. That's an uninterrupted source of narcotics for a period of time. There's heads going like this. That doesn't happen at the Lions Club, okay? I just want to tell you that. A couple of guys with a little drool coming out of their mouth, you know. Dental surgery. Only at an AA meeting, man. And why I went to that AA meeting, I couldn't tell you, but I went. And I walked into that meeting, and if you're anything like me, and you're new here today, you're looking around this room tonight, and you're saying to yourself, Alcoholics Anonymous. How did I wind up in Alcoholics Anonymous? How lame is this? This is beyond lame. This is beyond church, beyond synagogue. This is some plateau of lameness I never even imagined was available to me. Alcoholics Anonymous. Welcome. Welcome. And everything was a miracle, 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 miracle. The furniture's a miracle. The coffee's a miracle. It's a miracle. Yay. My skin still crawls, you know, when I think about it. I hated everything about Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you're new, I want to tell you, you've stumbled into a great AA meeting. I walked in here, people got their hands out to me. There's prominently displayed Alcoholics Anonymous literature out there, and all I've heard pretty much is people talking about alcoholism up here. And if you're new, I just want to tell you, congratulations, man. You hit the jackpot. Because sometimes I can go to an AA meeting and not even hear a passing reference made to God, the Big Book, or the Steps, and it confuses the hell out of me if all I hear is about issues and boundaries. I get really confused. And there's nothing wrong with issues and boundaries, but here's the hook. You need to not drink to have one. The not drinking part is a moose. If it was not for the not drinking part, we would be a much bigger organization. I guarantee it. Because a lot of people want our deal, but it's that gall darn not drinking thing, you know? Don't drink, you'll have an issue and a boundary. I guarantee it. If you're new and you're wondering when you're going to get in touch with your feelings, stay sober. They'll get in touch with you. If you knew, and you snuggle up to go to bed, and Satan descends from the ceiling of your room, those are your feelings getting in touch with you. And I stuck around for Alcoholics Anonymous for 6 months and enjoyed the gift of step none. You know the gift of step none? Nothing. And I knew what I was going to drink. I had seen the AA drill in 6 months hundreds of times. People came in, did the work, changed. People came in, didn't do the work, didn't change. Got sick, got sicker, got to the podium, shared their gift with us. And then shared their ass right out of the door. Or stayed here and became sexual predators in columns of human sewage. Although I judge no man. I judge no man. I'm just too darn spiritually developed to be judgmental. You can pick them out at the meeting pretty quick. They usually have veins pumping like a garden hose on their forehead. They're very relaxed, happy. And I knew I was going to drink because I had seen it. I had just seen it too many times. And AA had reared its head in my home despite me. My wife had reached out to the Al-Anon family groups, and our sons had become a little less frightened. By the time I got sober, our older son, Micah, was making involuntary clicking noises with his throat that he couldn't stop making in school. He was grinding his teeth, reading years below his grade level. His small motor skills were all screwed up from being distracted all the time, from being scared all the time. Our son, Jesse, just lived behind the couch. He lived in that half-lit world, you know, where the alcoholic kid just gets right out on the perimeter, because that's the safest place to be when you live in a psychological theme park, you know? We were very, very sick. And I never really fully understood how sick my wife had become until she told me, you don't know what it's like to get an alcoholic nuts. Start in the morning. Start pushing them buttons. Get them going. Take your time. You got all day. Line them up. Tick them off one at a time, you know? Get them going. And when he's completely psychotic, then it's time to step right up into his face. Then it's time to get right up in there and feel the saliva spray as he screams at you, you know? It's like being on the prow of a ship. It's a beautiful thing. It's better than the smell of napalm in the morning, you know? Very, very sick woman. And I didn't know. I didn't know. Not until I really got exposed to Al-Anon, the Al-Anon family groups, and met Nancy's sponsor, I really didn't know what it was like for those people who love us and stay with us. So I knew I was going to drink. I was 6 months sober, and I asked the guy to sponsor me. And he was a good guy. I went to a good guy for something he had to give me, rare for me. I usually went to drowning people and asked for swimming lessons. You know, that was my M.O. And when all they'd say is glub, 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 I'd get pissed off. Why I went to a good guy for some... I think one of the reasons is the idea of being an A.A. loser. A.A. loser, mega loser, turbo loser, a loser on the Mount Olympus of losers. The idea of being an A.A. loser was so unconscionable to me. I couldn't even get my brain around it. I mean, and the fact is the guys who I rely on are my sponsor was an 8-year loser. My other spiritual advisor was a 10-year loser. So if you're an A.A. loser, we need you, man. You're these spiritual Goliaths of the future here, as far as I can see. But I asked this guy to sponsor me, and he invited me over to his home, and he made sure I had done some reading from the big book of AA. And he read chapter 5 to me, and on the way through, he took me through the first two steps. We reached step 3, and we said a prayer together. He finished chapter 5, and he went back, and he gave me instructions on how to do a fourth step from the big book of AA. And I didn't have, like, you know, the sky didn't light up or anything, but I will tell you this, and I know this for sure. That day, I stopped feeling like I was stealing somebody's seat in Alcoholics Anonymous. That day, during the book study, during the step study, I knew I had done some of the work they were talking about. And I really started feeling like a member of AA. I took 3 months and I did my inventory. I went back to my sponsor and read my fifth step at 9 months of sobriety. I did step 6 and 7 for the first time. And then it came time to do my 8-step list. The best reading of the 8-step I've ever heard, and I try to share it anytime I talk, took place at my old home group, and it was done by a guy named Nino. I've never seen Nino before this night, and I've never seen him since, and I don't think I'll ever forget him. He had a heavy New York accent. He had never read chapter 5 before. And he was at this men's group, and he was reading chapter 5 for the first time, and he got up to step 8, and he read, "Made a list of all those we had harmed, and became willing to make amends to them all." Jesus Christ! And he looked out into the room as if to say, "Have you seen this? Do you know what's in here, man?" It was so beautiful. It was the purest reading of that step I have ever heard. Because it's all I saw when I saw the steps. I didn't see any other step. No, no. Not those people, not that money. I would not have taken that much money if I knew how to give it back. Right? No way. Not the car. Well, if you knew, don't worry about it. It's 8 steps from where you are anyway, for God's sake. And it's not 8 that's really annoying. Nine. And I made up that 8-step list, and I put my wife and my kids and my dad down there and a bunch of other people, and I started doing my job in AA. And I didn't know what the hell I was going to do. My dad was dead. I couldn't see him. I didn't know how I was going to make those amends. I didn't know what I was going to do about... Let's see, I'll sit down with Nancy and I'll say, "Gee, hun, sorry about this 8-year journey to Hades. Okay?" "I don't think so. Gee, boys, sorry you've had no life." I had to start doing a lot of lame crap. I start like going to flag football games and coaching Little League, spending heroin money on lunch boxes, and I had to stop telling my kids to go do their homework and start saying, "Do you need any help with your homework?" Not that I could help them. I don't understand a good portion of what they're doing, but what I can do is I can spend some of that cocaine money on a tutor. I could spend some of that alcohol money on some resources. And the most difficult thing for me, I could go into that school and advocate for my kid and sit down with the teacher who is punishing my kid because he can't stop making these clicking noises and sit down with her and say, "My son's sick. He comes from a very sick home and we're getting better and he has no choice and he can't stop making them and you must understand he's not doing this because he doesn't respect you. He's very ill because I'm very ill." And we had him tested, and he got resources. My kids have received great educations in the L.A. Unified School District. Great educations. In great part because my wife and I went in and admitted what had happened in our home and got resources available that are available to children, if you know how to tap into them. When Michael was 5 years old, he came up to me and he said, "Dad, is there anything such as God?" And I told him there wasn't. I told a 5-year-old baby there was no God. And I thought, man, I'm telling you, I swear to you, I thought I was giving him the real deal. I thought I was saving him a lot of time and trouble that he wouldn't have to get played like a sap or a sucker by those saps and suckers out there. And what I had done was I told a 5-year-old baby, in essence, "Sweetheart, you know when you're scared and it's late at night and your head hits the pillow and it's too scary to go to sleep and it's dark? Tough. Because that's all there is." That's really, in fact, what I told them. And you guys came and got us. You came and got us. I started sponsoring men pretty early in sobriety, my first year, and I sponsored this guy named Roland. And Roland used to call our house every night and leave a message on our machine and would say, "Scott, it's Roly. I love you. I'm sober. Good night." And he'd hang the phone up. 5 years later, I was about 6 years sober, and my older son, Micah, came to me, and he said, "You know, Dad, when I was little, I couldn't fall asleep until I heard Roland's voice on the machine. And once I heard Roland's voice on the machine, I knew it was safe and I could go to bed." And this was at a time, and Micah had no idea this, Roland had just told me that he was positive that he had not helped anybody since he had become a member of AA. Micah didn't know that. It was just perfect. They were perfectly there for each other. They talked on the phone this morning, the two of them. Micah speaks fluent Spanish now, and they love to speak. They talk crap about me in Spanish to each other. You came and got us. You came through the back door, you came over the answering machine, and you came and got us. I started going to these Little League games, you know. Lame, lame, lame. And Nancy comes to the first game I'm at, and she takes a look over at the first base stands and just falls down laughing. Because there's all the people in the first base stands, and there's me alone in the sun, pissed off, you know. I'm here. I'm doing my job. I'm here. I'm making amends. I'm here. I'm going up and down two hat sizes. I'm just psychotic, you know, and the kids were thrilled to see me. Mr. Redmond's going to blow up, man, I'm telling you. Look at him. It took me a couple of years for the voices to diminish in volume and number to just go and sit in the first base stands, to just be with the people in the first base stands, to just be at my sobriety station. And a couple of years ago, Jesse's 15 now, and a couple of years ago, he received one of the greatest compliments I think a human being can receive anywhere on this planet. He was intentionally walked. Yeah, I mean, it doesn't get a lot better than that. If you're not a fan, that means they're scared of you and they want to get to the weenie behind you. And he didn't want to jump up and down and be a geek. You know, he just laid his bat down and he trotted up the first baseline. And on the way up the first baseline, he turned to me at my sobriety station in the first base stands. And he just shot me just that much stuff. Just a little bit. It's the old man. You don't want to spoil him. Don't be lame. Just a little. Little bit. Today, I was getting on the plane in Burbank. And I walked by a man who I haven't walked by in many years. I don't know if he's sober or not. I didn't stop to talk to him. And on the day of his child's birthday, and he was drunk again. And I knew, I talked to him. I know about alcohol, and I didn't pick it up in my reading. I know all about drinking. And I had told him all the stuff I knew about drinking, and then I had told him about my experiences with my children. I haven't been drunk at one of my kids' birthdays in 11 years and 10 months. So I was able to carry a message to this guy that is unique, certainly unique for me. And if you're new here, I don't know what your black hole is. I don't know what that thing is that when it comes up, you feel like you're getting hit by a cinder block. I don't know what your cargo of shame and agony is. I know that a lot of mine centered around my kids, a lot of mine centered around my collapse as a man, and a lot of mine centered around this lost father. And you guys said, do your job in AA, and I did my job in AA. And I started working with guys, and I was online one day to get lunch for work, and there was a guy in front of me, and he was getting, like, buying a can of Colt 45, you know, with, like, lint and loose change. You know the guy, you know, a half-eaten milk dud, right? And he had been there, like, a week, you know, and he turned around and he looked at me, and instead of in my best Bronx saying, what are you looking at? I said, how you doing? He said, you don't know how I'm doing. No one knows how I'm doing except for the people in AA. So we went outside and we talked, and I got a guy with more time than me, and that night I went on my first real 12-step call. And we were told by some people to just take the guy down to County General and dump him off at the door. Don't go in with him. Don't show them that he has any resources. Just leave him at the door and book. We didn't. We went through the entire process with him. I don't know why, but we did. And about halfway through up to the alcoholic ward, he turns to us and he says, I feel like I'm dying. And the guy I'm with says to him, that's because you are. And I pulled the guy aside, the guy with time. I said, how could you say such a cold, insensitive thing to him? I'm scared the guy's not going to like us, right? How can you say this to him? Now, the guy is in a county facility. He's been told to lie that he's got blood in his urine to break his way into an alcoholic ward. What is the guy supposed to say? You're just having a bad day. Just a bad day. This isn't a bad day. This is what dying feels like. I'll let you know when you're having a bad day. This isn't it. If you stick around here for any appreciable amount of time, you will see men and women come into Alcoholics Anonymous with bottoms that will make your hair stand on end. You will look at them and you will say, well, they're done. There's no way. There's no way. Not after this calamity. It's impossible for them to drink again. With what they've done to their family this time, with what they've done to themselves this time, with what's happened to them physically this time, to the kind of embarrassment they've become to their community this time, there is no way they'll ever drink again until they drink. until they drink, until they get the gift of step none, and they think their way right the hell out of the door. If they don't pick up the kit of spiritual tools laid at their feet, if they don't use this program of action outlined in a book, it has been my experience hundreds and hundreds of times that eventually it will not be their bottom anymore. It'll be a period of time where people were particularly nasty to them, thinking behind their back, doing all sorts of crap, and they will get on with the business of dying. And it is an extraordinary process to watch. Sometime after this, a guy who I sponsor told me to take a hike and get off his back and stop talking about all this step crap. And he went and he ripped some people off at AA, and he stole a car and ripped off an apartment. He was making me look pretty bad. And I wanted to explain a few things to him, and my sponsor suggested, no, why don't you sit down and write a 10-step? You've been telling people where they stand in the universe, you know. I'm resentful at blank for ripping people off in AA and making me look bad. It affects my self-esteem, pocketbook, ambition, personal relations, and sex. A five-bagger for sure. What are the defects of character that if God would remove, the resentment would be gone? What am I going to ask God to take away? The guy, the money, the apartment? What am I going to ask God to take away? Resentment's no big deal. It's just the source of all spiritual illness, the great destroyer of all alcoholics. It'll cut you off from the sunlight of the spirit, drag your ass out, and kill you dead. But don't be alarmed. No biggie. Relax. Work a step a year. I'm going to die. No big deal. I just get to die. What am I going to ask God to take away? I'm spiritually prideful. How dare a man comport himself thusly after coming into contact with someone of my spiritual caliber? It's unbelievable. And every resentment I have against every meeting, everybody in AA who's not doing it my way, who's not working the steps the way I think they should be working it, who's not sharing the way I think they should be sharing, every time that tweaks me, I suffer from spiritual pride, and I'm sick of it. I'm sick of it. I'm not so new in the program anymore that I have to individuate and push that stuff away so hard so that I know I'm okay. I know I'm okay. I just don't like being uncomfortable here anymore. Some people share, and they're helping people, and I'm not on the list. You know, people will walk out after this talk and they'll go, oh, well, I hope his plane crashes. I mean, you know, and some people enjoy it. Some people, most of you won't even remember who the speaker was this week in a couple. I'm talking to, totally self-obsessed people. I mean, who cares? Spiritually prideful, ashamed, a people pleaser. I care more about the way I'm being seen than what this guy's going through. I'm a retaliator. I'm judgmental. I'm playing God. Things are not going according to the Scott Redmond program, a fabulous program. And I go to God in 6 and 7 and I say, please remove these defects. Humbly ask him to remove them. Humbly isn't, take them if you can, big guy. Humbly isn't, take them, you rotten son of a bitch. Humbly is, Pop, I cannot do this anymore. I am just whooped. Can you help me out? What do you want me to do? What do you want me to do? I'll do it. Please do my work. I'll do your work. When we drew close to him, he revealed himself to us. And that's what I had to do, and I kept my mouth shut. Sometime after this, this guy found out he had a fatal illness. And he was told by a city agency that all they could do is take him down to County General and dump him off at the door. I knew that that wasn't true because I had done my job in AA. And he couldn't call anybody else because I guess the people around him had either told him what they had thought of him or he had burnt them out. I kept my mouth shut because I had done my job in AA. So he got to call me, and I got to be there for a man during his death when I couldn't be there for my father, and my dad came back into my life. And he didn't come back in a hot flash. I just found that I was able to start talking about him. I realized my sons had no relationship with him because I was too ashamed to talk about him. I didn't have any pictures of him around. So I was able to start telling his grandsons about him and start telling funny stories about him. And when I'd think of him, that feeling of being whacked in the side of my head was gone. And you gave me my dad back. And I have had men look me in the eye and say, you don't understand, I can't get this because I was loaded the night my father died. Now, anybody in this room can help that man probably, but I could help him real good. I've never run over a child drunk and killed him. I can help the man who has, but not as good as the guy who has lived through that and is living happy, joyous, and free. Not problem-free, but free. You know?
I fancied myself a show business big shot when I came into AA. I had this writing job, and at the end of the first year, I was up to direct the situation comedy down in California in LA, and I didn't get the job, and I almost drank. And I was humiliated. I went to my sponsor. I told him what I had done, and he said, I guess you have the show business God. I said, what? He said, well, what keeps you sober? I said, God. He said, well, you didn't get a show business job, and you almost drank, so I guess the show business God has failed you utterly. You better sit down and write the 10 step, because I had the resentment against the company for not giving me the job, and the resentment against myself for almost drinking. He said, when you talk to God in 6 and 7, you better talk to him about what you're going to have to do to stay sober. And when I came to AA, I heard God getting people into relationships, God getting people jobs, God getting people parking spaces, you know? No, not the parking God, not the parking God. What if you don't get a space? And if you do have a parking God and he gives you space, pass it on. Never mind. So I had to start developing a God that was big enough so a lot of things happened in his universe and I didn't get to drink. So when I did step 6 and 7 that day, I said, Pop, take it. Take show business too. You can have the show business. Just keep me sober. I'm willing to do anything. I'll do anything. Just keep me sober. And within 3 months, I was working as a cook on a catering truck. And I looked up to God and I said, I didn't mean this. No way. We have had a grotesque misunderstanding. I did not mean this. Now, in Los Angeles, when they make a movie or a TV show, they hire a caterer and you follow them around and you make them food and you make a lot of dough. It's like a great job. It's Teamster dough. You're on a vehicle on a movie set. It's a great job, but I'm Scott Redman. So the first movie I cater, the executive producer and star of the film, is a guy who I've worked with in the business. So that morning, he sticks his head on the truck and he says, can I have a burrito, Scott? And I said, what's happening, babe? He said, is this your truck? I said, no, but it's my spatula. I went home and I called my sponsor and I said, we're getting the gift now, pal. Oh, man, are we getting the gift now. Beautiful. He said, sounds like you've got a resentment. What, are they going to workshops to learn this, right? And I sat down and I wrote, I'm resentful at Scott Redman for working on a kitchen truck. I'm resentful at the guy. For what? For wanting a burrito? I mean, the guy was a nice guy. But he saw me on the kitchen truck, and I was resentful at God for putting me on the kitchen truck. God had gotten up that morning, kept Saturn on its axis, and put my ass on a kitchen truck. Get the Redman boy. Get him. Keep all the electrons moving around all the atoms in the universe and get the Jew. Get him. But that's the thinking, right? That's the thinking. And I started working that 10-step, man, and I started showing up every day and trying to give them a dime for their nickel and trying to be a good cook, and I managed to do it. And I came to my home group with stories of humiliation that the guys couldn't get enough of. They just loved it. I wound up serving people who had been my stage managers, my assistant directors, people I had directed in shows, and the guys could, they loved them, you know. I had a friend named Paul who I was able to help because he thought what I had thought, which is that I had fallen from a height when I came into AA. He didn't get it. He didn't get that the top rank here is child of God. And once you achieve child of God, you don't get to fall anywhere. Yeah, that's something to applaud for. That's something for all of us. And he used to say this prayer, and he'd say, Father, I'm willing to do anything for a living, but please don't let it be as bad as what you did to Scott. I was so happy to be of help to him, man. And I cooked for about 3 years, and then I was contacted by a company called the Ketchum Public Relations Firm in New York, and I was being considered for a big comedy writing job, and it seemed right to me. It seemed like getting this job would be good for the men that I sponsor. show them prosperity and sobriety. And I went mad before I even, I did this videotape for them and I went mad. Before I even heard about the job, my brain blew up, I went nuts, and I surrendered it, did the 10th step about it before I even heard about it. And shortly after that, I get a call from Ketchum telling me that I did not get the job, and I was okay with it. I had already released it. I hung up the phone. And then right after that, I get a call asking me to cater some commercials in Lake Arrowhead in the mountains above L.A. So I hop in the truck, and I get up there, and I grab the call sheet, which, you know, has all the information about the commercial, and the commercial was for Ketchum Public Relations. I'm cooking for him now. Now I'm cooking for him. And I look down at the end of the truck, and there's a guy with a videotape camera, and he's taping me. I said, well, what are you doing? He said, oh, we're taping the making of the commercial. He's taping my humiliation. So he's going to go to New York with the tape, and they're going to look at it in New York, and they're going to go, is that Scott Redman with the meatloaf there? Oh, the poor son of a bitch. So I go home and I call the sponsor and I said, oh, we're getting the gift now, pal. Oh, it's a miracle. Miracle, miracle, miracle. He said to me, I guess God had enough writers and he needed a few cooks today. Then he said, you know, you asked God to work for Ketchum and you forgot to tell him what you wanted to do. Years later, I was directing a TV show on the Universal lot, and this grip stopped me there. Grip's a guy who does a lot of the heavy work on a movie set, physical work, and he said, came up to me and said, you're that sweet caterer, God. You're such a great guy. He said, what are you doing on the lot? I said, well, I'm directing the show on stage 46. He said, did you go right from the catering to the directing? My wife and I, Nancy, are having a great time. We just celebrated 20 years of marriage. We're having a great time in Alcoholics now and Al-Anon. And we had to stop working on our marriage. My idea of working on a relationship is to talk to you until you change your mind. You know, that's my idea of working on a relationship is to talk to you until your eyes roll back into your head and you keel over and on the way down you go, oh, okay. And I am convinced that is not because God loves us more than the people who are getting divorced. It's just what's happening in our house. We got nailed in the Northridge earthquake. I mean, like, real bad, you know? And shortly after the quake, we were at an out-of-town function, AA function, and this woman said to me, oh, I'm so glad God got us out of L.A. before the quake. And I said, oh, so he likes you, but we're crap, but he likes you. And she said to me, no, I guess he just felt that you had some lessons to learn. Oh, bartender. Right? I'm out of here, man. If I got a God up there saying, get the Redmond boy, get him, no evacuation plan for you, kill his goat, put a finger in his eye, turn his wife to salt. I'm out of here. My God expects me to do my job in AA if Nancy and I are together or apart. He expects me to do my job in AA if my kids got better or they didn't, and they did. They happened to. I had an 18-year-old son. When I'm sitting with him in front of a computer the other day, we're talking, and he put his head on my shoulder. That's not part of the 18-year-old mandate. To blow my ass up is the 18-year-old mandate. We're really having a great time. I have a lot of personal problems, and I'm having a great time in Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're new here, I want to welcome you to AA. I want to tell you that I think you're in a very dangerous situation. Sometimes a newcomer will say to me, you know, drinking is the furthest thing from my mind. To which I usually reply, no, your mind is the furthest thing from your mind. To the best of my knowledge, virtually the entire big book of AA is engineered to try to drive home one idea, that if you really have this thing, if you have this threefold bizarre mix, and drinking is the furthest thing from your mind, and you have every reason in the world to stay sober, if you will profit from it, if staying sober will mean success personally, professionally, sexually, in every way, shape, or form, you drink. You put whiskey in your milk.
You cross the threshold of the hotel and say a couple of cocktails would be swell for dinner. And I want to tell you that if you get up to the 10th step, it says sanity will have been restored. It doesn't say that you'll refer to your brain in the third person as if it's some unwanted alien dashing around your house planning your demise. That you don't have to live like your head's out to get you. Step 11 says the occasional hunch or inspiration will slowly become a working part of the mind. Step 10 says the alcohol problem will be removed. You won't even be cocky. It'll be gone. And sanity will have been restored. The road doesn't get narrower from me in AA. All the first 164 pages talk about is life getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And I want to tell you, when I got free enough from self-loathing and jealousy and insanity to actually start taking pleasure in the good fortune of other people, my life started to generate space and room that I never even dreamed of. If you're new here, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. Welcome home. Thanks so much for having me up tonight.